Tech Talk with Jess Kelly. This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome along to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up over the next hour, how do smart meters work? And more importantly, can they save you money? Our book club will be in to review Bad Blood, which tells the story of the infamous Elizabeth Holmes. And as ever, I'll answer your tech questions. If you want to get in touch, you can do so at any stage. You can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com, or you'll get me on Instagram at JessKellyNT. There is so much to talk through this week, from the dynamic pricing at Ticketmaster to the CyberSafe Kids report that was out earlier in the week. And we will do so a little bit later on in the show. But I want to start this week with smart meters. We are firmly in the era of smart everything. But I'll hold my hands up and say I didn't know a whole lot about smart meters until recently enough. We moved into our house last month and I have spent so much time reading up on the various ways to be more energy efficient and, of course, to try and save money. I'm delighted to say that Ruth Bougie of the SEAI is with me now to guide us through what they are, how they work and the benefits they offer. Ruth, thank you so much for joining us. As I say there, I've spent an awful lot of time doing a fair bit of reading recently. But for those who don't know, let's just start at the very beginning and remind us about what the SEAI is and what it is that you do.
Certainly. So we've been in existence since 2002, and we do offer a whole range of supports to householders in terms of information and awareness about how they can change their behaviour and reduce energy costs and carbon emissions, but also a whole range of grants as well. But we've a whole other range of different programs in SEI, from grants to electric vehicles to sustainable energy communities. We run workshops in schools. We do data and insights around national energy use. So we have a very significant research and demonstration program as well. So there's an awful lot going on there. So it's an exciting time, Jess, in terms of the house buying and all that you have to learn. So I'm sure it's been quite an interesting curve there, trying to get to grips with everything in your own home and see what's possible.
There is so much information, but the good thing is that it all seems quite digestible. Once you do the research and a bit of legwork, it all comes to fruition. One thing that I'm really curious about, though, is the smart meters. I've heard a lot of talk about it. Can you just introduce the very concept of a smart meter and who would want it and why?
Of course. So the Smart Meter Programme is a national programme to replace all of our old, what would be called mechanical or analog meters, with digital meters that allow for the collection of how much energy you use and when you use that electricity. So it's a way of using data to help inform and change our behaviour around electricity. And it'll also help us absorb the 80% renewable electricity that we want to bring into our grid by 2030. The biggest question we get out when we go out to reach communities and householders is, where do I start? And it's usually that thing of, you've bought your house, where do you start with all the information that's there? This is one way to help guide you. So if you understand your electricity use, you can see what options you have and where to focus your limited resources in making changes.
Okay, so let's start there then. So, because I know from using different smart home technology, so whether it is Google Nest, or obviously there's the Amazon technology that's there, people will be familiar with, you know, when you set that up on Google Home, for example, I can go in and I can see my light bulbs, I can see the cameras that I have, I can see the smart devices that I have, and I can control and interact with them. I can see what's playing and so on. Is this something similar that I'll be able to get that level of information on my phone, or how do I access it?
So at the moment, the electricity usage that you have is collected every half hour over the course of 24 hours in your home. And at midnight, that information transfers to your electricity supplier, who will make it available to you in some version of an app or a website the following day. And that shows you how and when you used electricity. Some suppliers can even identify which types of appliances used electricity. So it's a way of looking at your previous usage and going, okay, hang on, I didn't need to switch that on at that time. Maybe I could move that to a different time and see which types of time of use tariff. So it's really guiding you towards finding a time of use tariff that works for your household so that you can make energy savings. Our electricity costs the most and is in most demand between 5 and 7 in the evening. So if we can move households out of that hour of time, or those 2 hours of time, it can help bring about cost savings. Now, that's not to tell anybody they shouldn't be eating their dinner between 5 and 7 or they can't do what they need to do, but possibly they don't need to run the wash machine, the dishwasher, the tumble dryer, the Hoover and a hot shower simultaneously at that time. And moving some of those behaviours to a different time of the day could result in significant savings. Some suppliers are providing electricity at nighttime for about 7 cents a kilowatt hour, as opposed to 30 cents during the day at peak hours. So it's a very significant opportunity there to make savings. From the Google Nest and the Google app that you have, we do expect technologies like that will come about over time and will be developed in line with what people want. So I kind of say there's two types of solutions that we expect to see. One is one you interact with. So very much like you decide, I'm going to set my heating a certain way. But you kind of fit and forget in that situation. You set up certain behavior approaches and then there's self-learning within some of those tools. So I know my home heating device will detect if I measure the house for more than 24 hours and will switch off the hot water. So I don't have to even consider the fact that I didn't turn off the automatic hot water on those hours. So it's that kind of thing. And then there's the ones that you want to interact with that do things for you or that you want to change on a daily basis. So they're the two types of technologies we expect to see continue to develop. But there's a lot out there already. And it's really interesting for those of us that like to get into that kind of side of things.
And I am such that person. I noticed that the washing machine that was already in the house, you can set it, you can delay that it comes on at certain times and all the rest. And as you said, once you build in those habits, they become second nature and you don't even think about it after a week or so, which is fantastic. In terms of this is a stupid question, so bear with me. What do I need to get a smart meter, and can every address get one, or do you have to be, you know, a detached house or semi-detached house or whatever?
Every household can get one. Some house types were left till later in the installation process due to additional technical challenges. So some apartments were later than other households, and they were deployed since, I think, 2019 on a kind of regional basis. So in order to get economies of scale, different areas were targeted and the installers went out. So every household gets one. So you do not have to pay for one. You can refuse one if you want to, but you have to physically opt out. You have to ring ESB networks and register that you don't want one at all. But in terms of getting one, it's very simple and straightforward. It took about half an hour here at my house and I continued to work through the very short outage and the work being done. And mine was inside my house because I have a very old house. So there's no problem there in terms of everyone getting one. There are a very small number of households that have difficulty getting the communication connection from their home due to locations and other technical challenges. But we're at about 1.9 million smart meters installed to date. So they've gone in really well and really successfully. What we're not seeing as much success on, and we'd like to encourage, is the adoption of the smart tariffs. So getting people the interacting with the smart meter information and seeing what kind of tariff would suit them. And on that, there is an option to move to a 24-hour tariff that is smart. So when you get your smart meter installed, it will go through a series of connections with ESB networks to see is the information transferring okay. And once it does, after about a month, you can then opt into a smart tariff, but you don't have to. And if you don't opt into a smart tariff, your information is only gathered once a month. So you won't get the bill shock, but you won't get all of the services that you could get from a smart meter. And as I said, there is a smart 24-hour tariff for anyone who's apprehensive, which is going to be no more than what you're currently paying and could be less. And it allows you to see what your behavior is. And over time, you could see a tariff that works for your household and make those savings.
Is this extra beneficial for those maybe who are working from home or, you know, for people who are in the house a lot more? Like I leave the house usually around 7:30 every day and I'm out, but my partner works from home. Like, is that beneficial in terms of getting an idea of, you know, how much usage is coming from, you know, the laptops and all the other devices that are on while he's working and so on?
It is, but it's also great in terms of, well, when you're working from home, you realize you can put your clothes on the washing line during the day and you're not doing it at nighttime. So you can stagger or you can run the wash machine late, like at 2 o'clock in the morning, and you can put the washing out first thing in the morning. But it also allows you to, yes, certainly understand your daytime usage. If you are interested in getting solar PV for your home, it would help identify what size your home would need, because you'd understand what your usage would be. You'd understand what the base load is when there's nobody there. I'm sure it's sometimes your partner's not in the house and you can say, hang on, why is there still things being used as electricity? Because we've nothing switched on. So you can start to, you know, go after those little energy users that you're not aware of. So things like your refrigerator and some of your small devices might be using a small amount of electricity, but your refrigerator is probably using the most amount when you're not there, kind of thing. It cycles on every kind of a third of the time. So it's doing what it needs to do in the background, but everything else should pretty much go to zero. So it does let you compare, but it also gives you much more freedom around changing your behavior. So you might be comfortable leaving a slow cooker on during the day when you're at home. You might have the option of having what my dad calls having his dinner at lunchtime, dinner time, and having his tea at tea time, instead of the other way around. So it depends on what you're used to, but it does give you a lot more flexibility to understand what behavior changes make a difference.
I had read, I don't know, I think it was earlier this year, that some people were opting out of buying into the notion of smart meters and they didn't like the idea of them and so on. Like, are there reasons for that? Are there reasons why people are apprehensive? Because again, from my brain, and I've been a homeowner I think 4 weeks now, so maybe I'm missing something here now, but anything that gives me insights into what we're using and also how we can save money sounds good to me. What's the feedback that you're getting from people that might be a bit apprehensive about it?
I think some people are concerned that other people would know when they're in the house and what they're doing in their house. And in the first instance, your data is not transferred live. So it goes afterwards, you know, it goes at the night of. So there's concerns around that. Some people feel that they're being surveilled while that's happening. They're not, and they're concerned about how their information is being used. And the very minute amount of information is being shared is literally what electricity is being used when. I'd say 94% of households in Ireland in 2022 had internet access. And interestingly, 54% had wearable devices. So when we think about the type of information we're willing to share, where we see a benefit, and I would see the analogy between a smart meter and a smartwatch being quite similar. It's catching how many steps I do, and I can choose to use that information to change my behavior, or I can happily ignore it. So it's finding a usage from the data that works for you. I think there was concerns very early on in the development of smart meters that people might be remotely disconnected. And that's not happening. There still has to be a visit to the household if there's going to be a disconnection. So I think that that might have alleviated some of the concerns. But broadly, it's been very, very successful in terms of getting 1.9 million in. You know, I think as an installation of a project like this, it has been very successfully. And as I said, broadly neutral in terms of people's concerns. But the next stage is the time of use, and it's the behavior, and it's the response to that. And does that help us manage our grid more efficiently? And does it allow us to integrate more renewables? And do people respond to information when it's made available to them, such as how many steps you walked?
But that is a good analogy, though. And, you know, that's something that we've spoken about on the show before in terms of the health tech and so on. I am that kind of person that maybe not instantly I'll change my behaviours, but the more data you have and the more that you can see, well, you should put the washing machine on at 8 o'clock rather than 5 o'clock because you could save your pennies. And it does all add up. Does that mean that there's no benefit to getting a smart meter unless you take those steps?
No, there is a lot of benefits in terms of, one, there's no more bill shock. So regardless of getting a smart meter, so if, once you get a smart meter, and even if you don't activate a smart plan, you'll still not get the bill shock. So you won't have that experience of getting an estimated bill into the future. So that's a huge concern for people, particularly if you're struggling to, in the wintertime, to meet the bill requirements, that you're not going to accidentally underpay for a couple of months and then get a large bill, or get a large bill that you haven't actually used as yet. So there's that component to it. But I would encourage certainly the smart 24-hour tariff, just to understand what your opportunities are. An average household in Ireland uses about 11 kilowatts of electricity. But what's average, and what's average for your household? And is something going wrong that you could change? Is there a behavior in there that small change could make a big difference to your cost? And how can we help with that as well? And we do have a considerable portion of the country in or at risk of energy poverty. And more information in that space will be really helpful in terms of trying to find solutions. Certainly, the more technology enabled your home is, the greater the benefit opportunities are. So selling back electricity from PV, using a smart heat pump, and future opportunities could be to take in really low cost electricity from the grid, using your home as an effective thermal battery at low energy times. I personally have an electric car, and I've worked out that for 15,000 kilometres a year, if I charge at home at night, that costs me about €150. So that's a saving of about €2,500.
God, that's huge. And again, that's all behaviours and using the information to make more informed choices. The other thing that I'm curious about, and I know a few people who have it, which is the pay-as-you-go heating facilities and electric facilities at home. if they do have those meters, particularly in rented accommodation, for example, can you get smart meters on that, or is that defunct because you are paying as you go?
No, there is a smart pay-as-you-go meter available, and there is an option with some suppliers to get an in-home display. And with those, there's extra benefits in that you can now buy your credit online much more easily. So there's no more running out to the shop at the last minute to top up the meter. You can do it in different ways. So there's very much information in that space as well. And I said that in-home display option for some pay-as-you-go is there too. The rental sector is a challenging one because householders in some cases don't have the option to change the type of meter that's there and make the type of behavior changes or appliance switches that they would want to do. So it's definitely an area of interest for ourselves. We are developing a smart energy hub on our website. There's information there about that smart lifestyles and smart living. And in time, you'll be able to upload your energy use profile to that, and we'll be able to guide you to the different options that would be there. I would like to see much more flexibility around pay-as-you-go meters that people could opt in and opt out as appropriate so they could take advantage of the other benefits.
Yeah. And just to go back to the point of having the smart meter and knowing your usage and so on, that's obviously a tool in your arsenal then when you go to negotiate with your energy provider. You know, if you're moving providers, because Dara Cassidy from bonkers.ie, who's often on this program, is a huge advocate for moving supplier. And if I know what my energy usage is, obviously I know how much I'm paying. I'm better informed then in terms of those negotiations too.
Very much so. And you know what you're using and you know what you can change. And the last time I checked, which was about 6 weeks ago, there's about €800 difference in the average household energy use between the lowest and highest cost provider for electricity. So we spend about €2,500 between heating and electrical use in Ireland. That's a very significant amount of your spend when you add it all up. So, you know, if you can save 10 or 15% on that, that's a lot of money to save. So, you know, it's worth shopping around. Very few people do. What I'd say is all of our electricity is generated and effectively put into a virtual pool, and all the suppliers buy from that pool. So the electricity is exactly the same. You can change how much of renewables you buy potentially, but that's about the only difference. It's all as reliable as each other. You won't get more power cuts because you switch to a different supplier. So from a product comparison basis, it's exactly the same. So shop around for sure. It's not like broadband where you might get different qualities of services with different packages. It's the same. So best cost for you is definitely the best price.
Another stupid question coming for you now. There's been a lot of talk about BER ratings, and obviously there's different rates for green mortgages and so on and so forth. Is there more technology that's going to come? Because a lot, from my basic understanding of it, you know, a lot of the rating is based on, you know, the front door, the attic insulation, stuff like that. Does having the smart meter and other applications of smart technology in the home, does that have any impact at all? And can that help the overall efficiency of your home?
So to the best of my knowledge, the only measure that makes a difference on your building energy rating would be your heating controls. So having good heating controls, zoned and timed heating controls, makes a difference in your BER. The future of the building energy rating process is expected to include what they're calling a smart readiness indicator. So potentially that could encompass the smartness of your home. So that could be how good a broadband connection there is, how much smart technology is in your home, how much flexibility your home can offer to the grid and things like that. So it's definitely coming in the next couple of years, and it'll be interesting to see how that works through. We don't have full sight of it. But that smart technology option is really important. And a BER is a comparison tool of how two exact buildings would compare side by side. It doesn't take in usage. So like other things, how well you use your home can have as much of a bearing as what kind of home you have as well.
Okay, well, look, there is plenty of information on the smart meters and a whole lot more up on seai.ie. As I said, I've got it bookmarked on my laptop for the last little while, and it is a fountain of knowledge. Ruth, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here on News Talk.
Really enjoyed it, Jess. Thanks for having me on. Take care.
Yeah, that was Ruth Bougie of the SEAI. The other area that I'm really interested in is solar panels. Have you had them installed? Are you getting the benefit of them? I read somewhere that I think it takes 6 years to kind of become cost neutral with them. Is that correct? Get in touch. Let me know your experience. Let me know what provider you used and indeed the benefits of it. Techtalk@newstalk.com.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Now, I've mentioned it so many times over the last little while because I've been so looking forward to this conversation, but our book club is finally back. And this time we are talking about Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup by John Carreyrou. Cameron Hill and Kira Tracy are with me now. Guys, how are you?
Great, thanks for having me back on.
Yeah, thank you. Looking forward to this.
I'm Cameron and I have spoken about this a few times on the floor. We've both been itching to have this conversation. When I picked this book, I said, this is one of my favourite books and I have gone back to it multiple times. I've listened to the audiobook, I have read the physical book, I have it on my Kindle. And the reason I go back to it so often is because there is so much to it, right? It is an incredible masterclass in investigative journalism. There's suspense. There's, you know, corporate madness. There's bullying. There's character development. It's kind of like the ultimate thriller, but crammed into reporting on something that is completely true. Cameron, how familiar were you with the story of Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos from the outset?
I'd heard it kind of anecdotally. It's become in the last few years kind of a byword for just disaster and like investor gullibility. Mm-hmm. And as we'll probably get into the nature of Silicon Valley and, oh, this is the first big failure and it's great that finally they're being brought down to earth kind of thing. I didn't really know the intricacies of it or just how much of a buy-in there was. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that it was effectively an investigative journalism piece by the Wall Street Journal and Carreyrou that eventually brought it down.
Yeah.
And this is written like prophecy as well, which is interesting. This book comes out in 2018, if
yes,
I'm not mistaken, and a lot has happened since then.
Yeah.
And it reads in a kind of prophetic, I wonder what's going to happen to Elizabeth Holmes and Sunny Hawani after this. I'd love to read an updated version, a revised version at this point, but I absolutely loved it. There were so many strands. It kind of plods along. Mm-hmm. And then the last 50 pages are just this roller coaster of, I love a good legal battle.
Yes, so do I.
And it's like why A Few Good Men is one of my favorite films. And I love just the pace that it takes towards the end where you're fighting and they're getting to the sources and such and such. And yeah, it just combines that kind of Silicon Valley arrogance with investor gullibility and the idea of, who's going to be the next Steve Jobs? Like, Steve Jobs has such a spectral presence throughout this book.
Yeah.
It's so interesting.
It is fascinating. And Kira, that brings us back to our last book club, which focused on the autobiography of Steve Jobs' daughter.
Yes.
And we found that really compelling because it was quite a human, very empathetic, kind of soft expose of what it's like to be related to a tech genius.
Yeah.
And we'll do a summary of Elizabeth Holmes in a quick second, but she was someone who idolized Jobs. And it's that interesting correlation between the bits, the dickish bits of his personality,
yeah,
seemed to be what she tried to emulate when she started to get a little bit successful.
I know, it's actually crazy. And it's really interesting hearing you guys talk about the legal side and the tech side, whereas that kind of, I'm like, I take a back seat. I kind of gravitate towards the sociological side. So that is exactly my bread and butter, mm-hmm. Jess. I found it so interesting, the kind of persona she created and the way it really changed when the shit hit the fan.
Yeah.
If I can say that. You know, this kind of, again, I was just telling you before, the victim culture, the villainy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would never believe this was a piece of actual nonfiction.
Yeah.
Because of just how crazy it is.
There are so many twists and turns. And for those of you, like we have spoken about it, Emmett Ryan has been on this program with me, particularly when Elizabeth Holmes, when the trial was going on, and we spoke about the case at length. But just to summarise briefly, Elizabeth Holmes was this young, brilliant woman who was incredibly ambitious. She developed an idea, a notion for technology that would essentially allow you to take comprehensive blood tests with just a prick of the finger. And she was adamant that she wanted the device to be a certain size, work at a certain speed, but not compromise on the types of tests it could do. And she went from strength to strength. She collated a massive, almost Taylor Swift level of squad to back her and endorse her and all the rest. But as we now know, Theranos did not succeed. In terms of the book, jumping into the book, What were your initial impressions as Elizabeth Holmes was introduced as a character? Because it starts off from a pretty pacey place, this book. And bit by bit, you're kind of learning little bits and pieces about Elizabeth Holmes as she was at the very beginning.
Yeah, it felt like a kind of, she was following a certain beaten path that Jobs had sort of created. You know, you go into the bits around her being this college dropout and having this idea, and kind of, they go into the whole thing of she wanted to be a billionaire and that was her big ambition. And immediately you get a red flag and you think, okay, this doesn't sound like it's going to end particularly well. Mm. She seemed idealistic and ideological, and certainly it's that enthusiasm for her idea and the optimism that seems to have been infectious to so many people that you get swept up in too. I found it, oh, this is interesting that she's so bought into this idea, and I'd be convinced by her. Like, that's one thing you get throughout the book until she kind of takes a backseat and David Boies becomes the arch villain. That you, if you were in a room, you could understand why she was so charming.
Yeah.
Why she was able to get so many people on her side and be basically the yin to Sonny's yang, where he's the mad dog about it, but she's the kind of beguiling, very romanticized inventor and someone putting forward this idea of, look how much we can change the world. And basically the prophet for what Silicon Valley always tries to do, which is be the agent of change.
Yeah. You've summed that up so well. I think the persona that she wanted to put out there is exactly what people want to see. Mm. Intelligent, young female looking to change the world. She had certain anecdotes that she would tell and retell about her fear of blood and, you know, wanting to make that process less painful. But Kira, what struck me the first time I read this was, as a young woman who was working in the media from a very young age, I could completely empathize with her thinking that she needs to change her persona to fit in. The changing of her voice and dressing in black.
Yeah.
Yes, it was based on Steve Jobs, but it's also because it was a male-dominated field as well.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to sympathise too much just because of...
But the human thing does kick in,
the human
right?
thing does, you know, it's difficult. You are being in a boardroom as well. And, you know, she's an attractive woman too. And I feel like that probably was the first thing men noticed rather than the intelligence, which undoubtedly she had, Jesus. But something I found really interesting... The difference between her and Jobs from a gender perspective, I feel like, again, this is just from small fry what we read through Steve Jobs' daughter's perspective. But I feel like the way they carried harm, the way they treated people, especially in the end, I feel like he was very mean, directly cruel, whereas she was a bit more malicious and conniving. Mm. And I feel like they are very gendered. You know, it's very interesting. She victimized herself. She would say, well, I'm a woman. That's why people are coming for me right now. Whereas he never had to, you know, use his gender as a reason for that, which I found fascinating. So there really is that kind of, I feel like, without getting too political, but that kind of white woman victimhood, whereas a white man doesn't necessarily have to use that. His power is implied, whereas she had to really use her identity as a reason for protecting herself.
Yeah, it is fascinating to see it. The other big character in this book, of course, is Sonny Balwani, who we will... I'm going to give you an update on where Elizabeth and Sonny are later on, but there's a menacing presence about him from the very first mention of his name, isn't there?
Yeah, I loved... It was something you flagged. It's like, wait until you get to Sonny and you start seeing him come into it. And he's kind of shrouded in mystery when we first meet him. We're not really 100% sure where he came from. They knew he came from money. And the sort of... The way that Carrie Rue writes it in terms of, oh, watch out for this guy and watch out for the nature of their relationship, because that's not immediately obvious to pretty much anyone they ever meet, is the romantic aspect of their partnership and the problematic connotations of that afterwards and consequences of it. But he becomes just this figure of ridicule eventually, where you just see any time... What's great about the book is they detail for ages each individual employee who comes in sort of starry-eyed, I want to help this really worthy cause. And soon broken down by the culture and the idea of everything being so secretive and the Chinese walls that are everywhere throughout Terranos. And it almost follows a pattern of they get disenfranchised and then I want to leave and Sonny has an outburst and basically tears them to shreds. And it's terrible, but I really enjoyed every time it happened because you're like, you're such a parody of yourself. It's incredible.
He is, you know, he's someone who was incredibly successful, very, very wealthy, well-traveled, well-connected, but he's every corporate employee's worst nightmare because he carries that ego alongside his money and his experience, and he uses the power of intimidation and his reputation to bully his way left, right and centre. And the way some of the anecdotes that Kerry Rue outlines of employees being fired or even when they go in to raise a concern and he just flips the lid, it's terrifying.
That's Steve Jobs.
But it's so funny. Like, there's a description of him being an erratic man-child of limited intellect and an even more limited attention span.
Love that.
Which it's such a great summation because later on, employees start to figure out that they can get through or pass Sonny by making these really convoluted presentations at one point that he just goes, signs off on. He's clearly not listening, but it means that they survive another day. So the way they outsmart this incredibly volatile, but as they say, a bit dim and dim-witted character is quite adventure booky in a way. They're starting to evade this terrible, terrible demon.
Yeah. But I think they had to survive, because early on in the book, there are examples outlined where, you know, they're going off to do demos to showcase this technology. It's not working on site in whatever country they're in. And so they're lying and making up, you know, the staff are being put in this position where they have to lie and make stuff up to survive. That is pretty terrifying. And you can, again, understand the pressure that the staff were under. But I just found it baffling that they weren't called out.
Can we talk about the scale of what Elizabeth Holmes promised the world?
Yeah.
Not just revolutionising technology, but the medical care, healthcare. Like, this was actually meant to be something, you know, that was going to change lives, potentially the way the US looked at healthcare. And it had the government backing. Mm-hmm. The lies, the scale of the lies, saying the military had been testing it and passed off on it. Like, it was actually crazy. Like, baffling. Sorry, even talking about it is baffling.
Yeah.
You know, the scale. So yeah, completely unfair. And I feel like Sonny and Elizabeth's relationship and the way Sonny went about things, I think was a microcosm of the whole company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, secrets, aggression, villainy. You know, they're from the main players anyway. George Schultz, that baffled me.
Yeah.
You know, someone who can be described as someone who, like, helped end the Cold War during the Reagan era, backing it to the point where his own grandson, Tyler Schultz?
Yes. So this is something that we need to talk about.
It
is the backing the company received.
Mm.
And again, please, if you haven't read the book, go and read the book, because it is just, it's like a who's who of every world, whether it's celebrity, politics, whatever you're thinking. They got behind this. And I'm just wondering, is that all down to Elizabeth Holmes' charm? Was she that much of an intriguing figure that people just bought into wanting this technology to exist first and foremost, but then also believing that she was this tortured genius who could transform healthcare entirely?
Oh, completely. I think there's multiple parts to that. I do think if you look at the example of Steve Bird, how much he wanted to get Safeway in, and this, he completely bought in and had to, again, like so many people in the book, lie through his teeth to his board constantly saying, no, it's coming, because Elizabeth's promised it's coming. So there is that aspect of they just want to buy into her. And they even describe, Kerry Rue gives a definition for FOMO, and that feels like exactly what everybody's doing. They do not want to miss out on this revolutionary idea.
Yeah.
But it's also this idea of effective altruism and just putting your money into basically an idea that sounds good. There's a really good book called Doing Good Better about this, where they talk about the play pump in Africa, which was designed as this kind of play toy, kind of a roundabout that kids would push and it would pump out water, and loads of people invested in this. The Obamas were a few, and I think Yeah, some really high profile people. Anyway, the thing was completely useless. Nobody wanted to push a pump all day. Kids got too tired to use it. But it's the backing because it sounds like such a good idea and has a great story. And Theranos seems to have been along that same line of this sounds like a great idea. I don't really understand most of the tech. And when you have that, when you have gullible investors who are willing to just buy into the idea, paired with technicians who at one point are described as engineers for whom patient care was an abstract concept. That's a recipe for disaster. And it could be, we haven't even got into the ethical part of just they treated this like an algorithm or an equation that could be solved rather than actual human beings being behind their equations and their problems.
But this is the bit that, like, the whole thing is outrageous, right? But the example that I alluded to earlier on, when a former Apple employee who comes to work for Theranos goes with Sunny to do a demo, and then she realizes that the technology is being used on patients who have real life illnesses. She raises concerns and she ends up leaving the company because she is so uncomfortable with it. And I think what this book highlighted for me throughout the book, not just with that one example, but there are whistleblowers and there are people who come out and don't just sit there and watch bad things happen. Now, a fair few people didn't necessarily, you know, blow the whistle. They just removed themselves from that situation. But the extent of what went on, I don't think would have happened, firstly, without those people who did blow the whistle. And then secondly, without brilliant people like John Kerryrew who put the legwork in to get this comprehensive story together.
Absolutely. And there's the people who leave the company, there's the people who stay, and then there's the absolutely tragic case of Ian Gibbons that we read about, which was a real shocking moment. That was something that stopped me in my tracks reading about that, just this guy who dedicated his whole life to the craft and is sucked into the vortex of Theranos and ends up, it ends up costing him his life. So I found that interesting, and it's a great case, as you say, about whistleblowing. Mentioned it earlier, it's a good case study in Silicon Valley's attitude to problems.
Yeah.
And the thing that it reminded me of in many ways is the Brian Johnson kind of immortality studies that are going on in Silicon Valley right now, where he's taking the plasma of his teenage son to extend his own life, his blood boy, as he calls him.
Notions.
Totally. It goes into this whole idea of Silicon Valley saying, hey, aging, can we stop that? Mm-hmm. Let's stop that. And this complete arrogance of, like, being able to apply their coding and computer knowledge to something like medicine, because, you know, how easy could that be? You know.
But I do think, like, if you scrape everything back, right, the notion of Theranos, even though it's not real, the notion of what it could potentially have done would have been transformational. And the whole point of this very program is to talk about inventions and innovations that are transformational. A few weeks ago, we did a piece about digital health records.
Yeah.
While it's not the same, it is a technological application of something that could transform and enhance the lives of every person in this country. Mm-hmm. So I could kind of see how and why people bought into it, because you also want to buy into it, right?
And it was very much achievable. If they just, like, made a few concessions in design where they didn't have to have it on this tiny little filament.
And that's where the ego comes in.
Yeah.
Is that Elizabeth Holmes did not want to compromise. She essentially wanted a blood reader that would kind of be like an iPod.
Yeah.
Because she was so obsessed with the Apple design. And it's the lack of compromise that I think was the ultimate downfall here, because anyway, we could go on for days. Keir, I just wanted to ask you, what did you make of the John Kerryrew's style of writing? Because I mentioned at the top that this is parts thriller. It's obviously factual.
Yeah.
It's, you know, memory recollection. I loved reading it. What did you make of it?
You know, it's actually interesting you say that, saying to Cameron this morning. I actually listened to it, which I never do. So this is me actually delving into it. And it felt like a true crime podcast. It genuinely did. But it's so interesting how, you know, it is so factual, and it was just, it felt like you were really delving into the character, and I say that in quotations. The quirks, like Elizabeth Holmes, she was scared of needles.
Yeah.
Didn't like blood, squeamish. And you do see the charm and charisma in that. It's just written, it's written like fiction. Well, it read like fiction in my head. It was absolutely fascinating. The romance, the whirlwind, the lies, the deceit. And you know what it really reminds me of? Because they obviously did make Dropout.
Yes.
The Amanda Seyfried TV show on it, mm-hmm. which I actually am dying. I want to see it in
it's quite good,
Technicolor
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
But it also really reminds me, going off topic slightly, but this is just so exciting. It really reminds me of Dopesick.
Yes. Yeah. Dopesick is fantastic.
I actually got the two of them based on real stories. Mm-hmm. You know, I really see this vision as something so similar to the opioid crisis in the US. This idea from every level of society, investors, doctors, trusted members of society were putting their trust and telling the people, you can trust this design. Millions, you know, came in and out of that industry. Mm. And it did affect lives. And sure, people were expecting blood results. It's terrifying, you know, putting lives were in people's hands that should not have been.
No, and I think it is now the... it's kind of like the shorthand for talking about what you don't want to be in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And I think it really opened people's eyes to the we don't want to be the next Theranos. And it also caused an awful lot of people from an investor point of view, from a journalist point of view.
Public trust
point of view to kind of question and then question again everything that claimed to be the second coming. Just briefly, because we're up against the clock here, but just to update you all, if you didn't follow the case, Elizabeth Holmes was convicted in January 2022 on 4 counts of fraud and conspiracy. She is serving 11 years at a minimum security prison in Texas and is expected to be out by 2032. Sunny Balwani was sentenced to almost 13 years in prison. And there's now calls, I think I read this in June, for that to actually be extended to 15 years.
He won't like that.
But that does show you the severity of it. If you've a bit of time at some stage over the next few days, go onto YouTube and watch the tapes of Elizabeth Holmes testifying, giving her evidence around the inquiries and the investigations that went on into Theranos and the ethics of the company and what really went on and the defrauding of investors and so on. It's, again, a masterclass in how not to behave, but it is fascinating. As I said, we could go on for much longer, but unfortunately we're out of time. So would we recommend this book?
Oh, yes.
100%.
Consume it in every way you can.
Yes.
Listen to it, read it.
So, so good.
I'm going to watch Dropout now.
Yes.
Like I'm itching to. I think Seyfried's probably a great actress for the role as well.
She does it so well. It's actually kind of unnerving how
good
she
is. Oh my God.
Okay, well look, there is a recommendation for you. It is Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup by John Kerry-Roux. Cameron, you're picking the book for next month?
Yeah, so Yuval Noah Harari, who people might be familiar with from Sapiens, has a new book out called Nexus, charting the development of information from Stone Age to our modern day and artificial intelligence, with a big emphasis on how our information technology and communications networks influenced the rise of Stalinism and Nazism and populism today. So
wow.
I think it's particularly prescient.
Okay, that is going to be our next book club pick. You've got 4 weeks to pick it up, digest it, form an opinion and share your thoughts. You can do so by emailing techtalk@newstalk.com. But for now, Cameron Hill and Kira Tracy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. We're going to answer some of your questions in just a quick second. If you have any, email me techtalk@newstalk.com. But before we do, John Faraday has popped in to talk about this week's screen time. John.
Jess.
Busy show for you.
Oh, baby.
So, gross. Go on.
Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, the long-awaited sequel. I flew to London last Saturday to interview Michael Keaton, Justin Theroux and Willem Dafoe about Beetlejuice. So great crack coming up with the three of them. And a very busy week because there's a new Netflix series on, a very good one, called The Perfect Couple. And I'm talking to Eve Hewson and Jack Rayner about that. And there's a completely different Irish movie all about a guy and his mother who's going through Alzheimer's, a great Irish movie called Don't Forget to Remember. Brilliant title. So every shape and size on this week's Screen Time. But I guess Michael Keaton is the big ticket item.
Well, he is. But the series starring Eve Hewson, I've read quite a bit about it. And people are saying this is one of the good ones that's on Netflix and it's definitely worth your time. So I'm excited for that.
I found it really entertaining. It's this idea of the perfect couple, and there were all these couples on this island, Nantucket, getting about for a big wedding, which Eve Hewson's going to be married in and Nicole Kidman's in it, and there are so many secrets under the carpet. It's just real entertaining. It's not making any point about, well, maybe it is about American aristocracy.
Yeah.
But it is a good kind of mystery and intrigue and people having sex when they're not meant to be and all that kind of good meaty stuff, you know.
So that's on Netflix. The Michael Keaton interview, I'm very excited. I never watched Beetlejuice, but my sister, my big sister, will often just say Beetlejuice and it freaks me out. She, like, it's her, she's a bit older than me.
Yeah.
And so it freaked her out as a child and then she passed that freaked outness onto us.
It's kind of a cult classic. And the thing is, it's Beetlejuice, which is what the sequel is called. It's not getting great reviews, but I think a lot of people are missing the point.
Mm.
It is this brilliant, I think, Tim Burton kind of weird way he has of making movies that are slightly all over the place but really entertaining, and Michael Keaton in it is more Beetlejuice than he was the first time. He's brilliant in it, you know.
It's funny, before the break, Kira and Cameron were in for our book club.
Yeah.
And Kira mentioned Dopesick.
Oh, wow.
And Michael Keaton is incredible in Dopesick.
He's having a late blooming renaissance, you know, because he was quite a bit in the noughties, but yeah, some of the stuff he's done lately, Dopesick, it's a while ago now, Birdman, The Founder. Oh, he's just a brilliant, brilliant actor. I mean, he slagged off my accent because I can't say me trees properly, or at least that's what he intimated. But you'll have to tune in.
I'll also slag you anytime you want. It's not just Michael Keaton. Okay, yes. Good. Right, well, if you want to hear Michael Keaton take the mick out of John, tune in after six. John, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Yeah, that is, of course, Oasis. And they, alongside Ticketmaster, continued to dominate headlines this week following the fallout of the sales for tickets for their upcoming reunion tour. Look, there's no denying that the entire thing was such a mess. Just last week on this show, we heard from Ticketmaster about some of the brilliant innovations that are going on when it comes to digital ticketing. But the on-sale process leaves so much to be desired. Senator Timmy Dooley spoke to Newstalk Breakfast during the week about what he would like to see happen going forward.
The primary reseller will have to put tickets at face value on the market, and then people have a choice to whether to purchase them or not. But this Dutch auction system being facilitated by the algorithms that are used in a cyber market environment, in my view, and I think in the view of most people, needs to be addressed. Of course, there's a lot of disappointed people who didn't get a ticket in the first instance. That's a separate issue. But it's those that were lured into a false sense of expectation of getting a ticket at an affordable price versus being ripped off, in my view, and expected to pay for it.
Thank you. Yeah, that's Senator Timmy Dooley speaking to Newstalk Breakfast during the week. I don't know what the answer is, but there has to be a better way. There has to be. That's just it. Let me know your thoughts. Email me techtalk@newstalk.com. But that's it from me this week. If you've missed any of the show, you can listen back in full on the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. I'll be back with Shane and Kira on Monday's Newstalk Breakfast. But in the meantime, have a great weekend.